Hang on, let me start the recording. Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome to the House of the Risen Sun with Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson. And every Saturday morning, we get up very early and chat about our lives in A Course in Miracles. And this has been just such a great series for me. I have enjoyed so much working with you on this, Bruce, and I'm so grateful that you chose to do that.
Me too. Very much likewise. Very much likewise. Well, a highlight of my week. Yeah.
Yeah, me too. And so, do you have something for us to look at this morning? Have you got any ideas? Or
well, I think we could probably just go into the FAQ and find something. I actually was a little preoccupied the last few minutes of looking. I got distracted looking at something on the web, and it's like, oh, that's time. I better get going. So,
kitty videos.
No, it's actually another course related book that I thought, oh, I didn't know about this one. So, and I was composing an email. So let me go to the facimoutreach.org and I will click on their list of all questions. And I'm going to go to part six, which is the last year that they had all the lists. And I'm going to jump back down to, how about 1290 something? Let's see what we have there. I'm going to get this one.
This is one
I think would
be. You got one?
Yeah. 1288.
Okay, great.
In fact, this is the one I think I ran across the other day that I was looking at. I thought would be a good one. So let me post that in the link.
Right.
Part of Skype.
Give me a link.
And that might be a good one.
There we go. Let's go check it out. So just in case people don't realize, these questions, a lot of people think that it's Ken exclusively who answered these questions, but not at all. I think there's a whole staff of people that were involved in answering these questions. So it was not just Ken's idea of what was going on. Lots of other people were involved. And those are some people like Rosemary Lasasso and Jeff. I don't forget Jeff's last name, but anyway, some really, really great folks. Yes. Yeah, I have a picture of me with him on my Facebook, and people always think it was Ken. Like, no, that's not Ken. You look like Ken. All right. Okay.
Cool. While you're looking that up, I was going to say I had a really interesting interview yesterday, which I hope to become an ongoing series as we've been doing, with Dr. Robert Rosenthal, who goes by Dr. Bob, of Foundation for Inner Peace, and the sister organization to Foundation for A Course in Miracles. And actually, they're part of the reason why any of us, in a sense, are studying this curriculum is because of the work of Judy Sketchwitz and putting this out there to the world, and otherwise we probably wouldn't have be having this conversation right now. Anyway, so
exactly.
So it was kind of fun talking with him because he actually literally grew up hanging out in the Sketch's home in New York City, and as a young adult and studying medicine, and it was just fascinating to hear his account in a lot of detail, and we had a lot of fun. So I posted a link in the chat there, so you might want to share that one too.
I might just download that one and play it here because I'm always looking for great content.
Okay,
so
good.
Definitely one of those kind of things. And a lot of folks are real interested in Bob Rosenthal right now for many reasons. He's going to be doing a workshop with Dove this summer in a couple of months. I don't know the details on that, but he wrote a very interesting, which you did send me, thank you for the link, a review of the new Robert Perry version of A Course in Miracles, which I thought was brilliant and not at all negative in my point of view. I think he really took the high road the whole way, and it was just beautiful.
I agree. I completely agree. And I thought it was very, not only even-handed, but intentionally non-adversarial and really demonstrative of not just the theory, but the practice of the principles of the Course suggests, which is that we're all one being, one thing. To exclude or to do battle in our minds with any seeming separate self or any other aspect of our projected being identity is really to go against the gentle admonitions of A Course in Miracles. So, yeah.
Absolutely. And, yeah. You know, it's interesting to me is how now the community, the Course community, is responding and reacting. And one particular Course community that I think, or maybe one particular Course teacher that I think has really made some pretty radical shifting in this area is Reverend Tony, mm-hmm. Reverend Tony Ponticello, who does the annual or biannual Course in Miracles conferences and has a pretty big following that come to those conferences. They're wonderful.
Right.
And I know a few years ago,
he now heads up the Community Miracle Center in San Francisco, which has a number of ministers that have gone through his ministerial program, right?
Exactly, the Community Miracle Center in San Francisco. So he, a few years ago at the Course in Miracles conference, he has often voiced his disapproval of the Foundation for Inner Peace and their handling of the course throughout the lawsuits and all that kind of stuff. And he personally felt that there had been some deception from the foundation, from the FIP version, because it didn't include all of these things that Robert Perry has so studiously put together. And so he at the conference expressed just some really radical point of view about all of this in the final teaching of the conference. And actually, a lot of people got up and walked out because they were so upset. But I found that that's kind of a norm with that particular conference. But anyway, so at the time, I was pretty upset too, because the title of the conference was The Holiest Place on Earth. And so when I go to something that says The Holiest Place on Earth, I'm going to find some closure.
I'm going to find a
place where people are like, no, that was in Vegas. But that's not the holiest place on earth. Although there's a reason. And that it is holy. However, I'm expecting, you know, some big announcement like, you know, I have, you know, come to realize that, you know, that all these versions are, you know, okay and nothing is bad and wrong. I expected that. So the speech I got was really upsetting. So, you know, I've known Rev Tony and it took me a while to really be able to just get my arms around this whole thing and to actually, you know, see that, oh, well, there's no reason to hold him accountable for any of this stuff, because it really is, you know, just a part of, you know, the ego thought system and not have anything to do with him. And so, you know, I forgave him, basically. Not forgave him because he did terrible things, but forgave him that he didn't do anything at all. He was just expressing an opinion. And this is what I've found working with him, is that he does not attack. He expresses opinions, and people perceive it as attack. And so, anyway, that's a kind of a long preamble to the point that I'm getting to, which is that just recently, within the past year, and even less than that, Rev Tony has started actually reconciling with the foundation. He went up there, they did a fundraiser for the translation program. He's been to lunch at Judy's place, and Bob Rosenthal is going to be a speaker at the next conference. So this is a tremendous shift in healing, really, that has occurred. And, it's because, to me, because this is what I asked to see. I asked to see this healing occur. It was a prayer of mine that, you know, this rift should be healed. And, you know, so I take personal responsibility for not for his change in behavior, but for my personal being able to see that it's not all black and white, and that, you know, people do shift. And so it's beautiful. Anyway, the reason I got on that is because now they are doing, the Community Miracle Center is doing a Thursday night study on Zoom of this new version.
Oh, okay.
And they're going through all the footnotes. Mm-hmm. They're going to go through every bit of it. Mm-hmm. He says it's probably going to take years.
Yeah, oh, I imagine.
And it, I'm sure
it's a very, very thick tome.
it's pretty thick. Well, almost half of, maybe probably at least a third of each page, probably on average, is footnotes.
Uh-huh.
So,
wow.
There, and references to the Bible and, you know, that kind of stuff. So.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it's really thick because of that. And plus they added in all the stuff that, you know, supposedly was taken out. So it's, you know, quite, I haven't started it yet.
But you've got a copy of it?
I have it here.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Because I haven't laid eyes on it. But I really like Bob's review, and I thought how you know, like we've been talking, it was even-handed in it. And I think the Cliff Notes version of his review, which was also pretty lengthy, warranted for a lengthy book, was that it probably would not be appropriate for beginning course students because they wouldn't have the context in which to understand the motivation for doing such a thing. Whereas for seasoned course students, it might, you know, very much be useful in the same way that, you know, after you've studied something for a number of years and want to know about the historical precedents and perhaps some of the backstory, if you will, that might be of interest and might provide further insights and context. I think, as he pointed out though in his review, Bob's review, there's so much material that really could be confusing to a new student that hasn't spent years and years studying the course. In the same sense that if you handed somebody a classic novel, but instead of handing them that, you gave them the rough draft by some, you know, famous author, they might have a different experience. They might, especially if the early part of the book, which is definitely the case in Course in Miracles, had a lot of marginal notations that, you know, led people off in different directions that may or may not be really the primary focus of the message. That could be in some cases not helpful. And so I think the way Bob prefaced it was, you know, saying, you know, he gave it a 5-star rating within the context of, for somebody who's been studying A Course in Miracles for, you know, probably several years at least, pretty intensively, this could be a very useful resource. But, you know, given that a lot of people that may not have that background, might look at it, they might, you know, might have kind of mixed messages going on, because there were things taken out that were out of context and were meant specifically for Helen and Bill and that kind of thing. So, yeah.
Absolutely. There's these cameos in the back, and I've only actually read one of them, and I probably ought to go and read those as well. But the first one, the one that I read, what I actually saw was that he had taken things that he had learned out of historical context from reading, like Absence from Felicity or Helen's autobiography, and then he writes about these incidences and then attributes, and then Jesus was trying to tell Helen this, but she wasn't getting it, and you know he's giving Jesus's motivations and Helen's motivations, and you know he's doing a lot of psychological you know, looking at, you know, why they're doing the things that they're doing, and really just make up a story. He just made up his own story about what he thought was happening there. So, you know, I think curiosity, yes, it's interesting to read. Do I want to see, you know, his idea of imagination of what was going on at the time? Not necessarily. He wasn't there, and you know, it's always easy in hindsight to look back at history and say, well, this is what they were trying to do, or this is what they were thinking. But there's no way to know what anyone was thinking at the time. And right, especially reading Jesus's mind, I thought that was kind of bizarre. But,
I think it's just another example of how we all do that by making up a dream and then interpreting it apart from that. Ironically, that inner kindness teacher, that which, aka Holy Spirit, which is what inspired Jesus to, you know, do this work. And I'm not talking about the biblical Jesus, but the Jesus of A Course in Miracles. That, you know, so, but we all do that. I mean, so it's not like there's any difference there, which is why, you know, the reconciliation, efforts on the part of all parties involved, is really symbolic of the process we're all going through of reconciling and recognizing that, you know, we are making up all these interpretations all the time of what we think is going on and what we think happened. And of course, in truth, anything involving duality never happened, but that's not our first step. That the first step really is to forgive ourselves and, you know, see that perhaps maybe somehow a belief in separation is responsible for the seemingly physical experiences we're having, and use it to get back to our mind and then use the specifics of our alleged lives here in this dream of a world to get back to the mind by you know, taking each seemingly specific thing and saying, oh wow, this is a projection of my mind, and I can see that my original intent as you know, out of the shoe ego, was to divide, but I can use that to restore the oneness by seeing the sameness. And I think that's you know, something we do moment to moment in our curriculum.
Excellent. That was a beautiful statement. That entire statement you just made was just gorgeous. Oh, I'm glad it's recorded. Because that is exactly what it is. It is the moment to moment. And I think this question that you picked is really going to help in seeing this. I like this a lot. Because yeah, it's a choice. It's a constant choice. And, you know, that's why Jesus says, you know, why do you ask how the tiny mad idea could happen? You're doing it now. You're doing the very same thing now. Ask yourself why you're doing this now.
Right.
And then you'll see, oh.
What passed? No se habla past. Explain past.
And
the future, what's that? Yeah. Do you want to read the question of the FAQ?
Yeah, let's get into the question.
Oh, okay,
of the FAQ.
Okay.
Because it's true. I mean, this really, I think, I've been looking it over as we've been talking, and sure enough, of course, you know, everything relates. We're living in a completely relational experience, holographic experience here. And so whatever comes up is always the perfect thing whenever it comes up, because that's the way, it's not necessarily the way the script was written, but it is absolutely the way that the Holy Spirit interprets the script, that everything is perfect in here for our learning, as we're told in the Course. So, you know, how
mathematically precisely perfect because if this is all part of our mind that we're seeing, in a form that we can, you know, grok and recognize, then every situation, whether it seems to be pleasant or unpleasant, is exactly a perfect opportunity to recognize what we've disowned, what we've hurled out like a big bang, seemingly into a world of otherness, And then reel back in and say, oh, that's really part of my mind. And if there's a discomfort or any kind of, you know, so-called negative emotion around my interpretation of that, that's where I rubber meets the road. I get to look at, you know, what my involvement in that relationship is and see it differently. I can see it through the eyes of forgiveness, which is basically saying, no, this is not something outside of me. This is something that I contributed to. There's nothing out there or no one out there to forgive. It's just my own mind that I'm forgiving. And in that context, it's easy because if someone else has to do the forgiveness, then I'm stuck. But if it's my mind and it's a simple, obvious choice between peace and happiness or the opposite, then, you know, well, duh. But that's not how we usually start out, is it? Yeah.
No, I love it. So, you want to read the question?
Oh, sure. So we're reading from, again, as we have been doing for, what, a couple of years now? Quite a while now. The frequently asked questions from the Foundation for A Course in Miracles. This is FAQ number 1288. And the headline is, can my outward misfortunes be attributed to my lack of forgiveness? So many of these, you know, revolve around level of confusion of one sort or another, don't they? And
absolutely,
this is no exception.
I just laugh when I request that first statement.
But we all go there in our minds quite often, don't we? I mean, because I think that's oftentimes, you know, we think that if we fix the dream, we always get it backwards. If I fix the dream, then my mind will be at peace. Well, no, it's kind of the other way around. Okay, so the full question is, this is again from facmoutreach.org, and we're number 1288. I was born into a difficult, abusive, and painful life. Spiritually, I began working very hard on myself using the principles of A Course in Miracles. I thought the fact that my outer life had so dramatically improved was an indication that I was doing okay spiritually. Then, through, quote, no fault of my own, unquote, downsizings and company closures, I lost my very good job, my house, my 401k, and even my friends. I went through a long, very dark and angry period and turned away from the Course, Jesus, and God entirely. Eventually, I worked through it, and overall, I think I've been willing to face some horrible things inside myself, as well as my apparent need to be a victim. I think I have also shown a willingness and an effort to forgive others and try to believe that I don't deserve to be punished. I know the Course does not say that a person's outer circumstances will change to correspond to inner changes, and I shouldn't expect them to. But I'm certainly not far enough up the ladder to entirely give up wanting and hoping for at least a little positive feedback in my outer experience. Does this ring any bells? I don't understand what happened in my mind to change my life so dramatically, or why my inner and outer efforts haven't seemed to make any difference. Could all of this have happened because of my feelings of separation from other people? If so, how do I truly fix my perception at a time when I'm feeling more separate and more different than ever? Can my script be changed? Wow, it seems like there's a lot in that.
A lot of misperception. In every single one of those statements is, I can see clearly the misperception that's there.
Right.
And,
right.
I've heard it. I've done it. Perfect.
I think it's because it's so familiar and because we not only have done it, but in so many ways continue to do it. And probably less and less as we learn from our experience, but then it'll still come up. Otherwise, you know, we wouldn't need this curriculum, right? Like Jesus said, you know, if you had, you know, perfect forgiveness from the get-go, you wouldn't need the atonement. You wouldn't need forgiveness. You wouldn't need to have this, you know, 1300 pages or whatever it is that gives you a blueprint for looking at the contents of the mind.
And I just was thinking about how before I even knew the course, and of course this is a long time, whenever I would have any kind of trouble, I would go into deeper and deeper, you know, meditating, doing whatever practice I was doing, thinking, you know, if I can just get this right, then everything is going to be better. You know, if I can just, you know, get this right, then, you know, my kids will start being better, my job will be better. You know, I really thought that being awakened was going to solve my problems in the world, because it would shift me into a different experience. And I even sometimes think that now, somehow or the other, I read in the Course that Jesus says, you know, you don't have to worry about what's going to happen. You I'll take care of everything for you. And so somehow some part of me and the ego part of me here is saying, well, that's like winning the lottery. You know, if I can get to that state, then Jesus is going to take care of everything. Even though I know intellectually in my mind that that is not what he's saying in any way at all, and that I'm just making that story up, that part of me still believes it. So, it is rampant in my mind. So this guy's question doesn't surprise me. These are things that I've thought my own self and still think to some extent. So.
Yeah. I mean, we still keep coming back to that because we forget that, there is that inner voice, if you want to think of it metaphorically, that says that, you know, we can trust, the awareness that we took with us into the dream that was our way out. We can't actually afford to trust that and, find the piece we're looking for, but it's not in the form. It's never going to be in the form. It's always in the content of the mind. But boy, we're so invested in the form because we made that up. And by golly, you know, if you're the author, you don't want to see your we call it a creation, but it's what we made using the Course of Jargon. We don't want to see that trash. We want to see that little, tiny fragment of creation that isn't even part of it somehow do it for us. We want to have that become our be all end all. And, because we're really, you know, we have divided minds. We're basically, as the Course would describe it, schizophrenic, but we're schizophrenic infants that don't even realize that we're still whining, to ourselves only, about, a dream gone awry, you know.
What happened to me?
Really? How come my dream isn't working?
So the last couple sentences in this paragraph, could all of this happen because of my feelings of separation from other people? Mm-hmm. If so, how do I truly fix my perception at a time when I'm feeling more separate and more different than ever? Can my script be changed? Yeah, hint, hint.
Yeah, and I think we answer our own questions, don't we? I mean, because I think in that paragraph, there are plenty of insights that this person is giving themselves as they write this question. At the same time, you know, and we all do this because we're a split mind, and we know the answer, but we keep thinking that we're going to find it where we know it isn't, and it's like the Mullah Nasruddin story of how he's out under the street lamp, you know, one evening and on his hands and knees and his friend walks along and says, what you doing? He says, oh, I lost the key to my house. And he says, well, where did you lose it? Oh, inside my house. And he says, well, and his friend says, well, what are you doing out here on your hands and knees under the street lamp? He says, well, there's more light out here, you know, but that's what we do. We think that we're going to find the answer in the dream. And, but that's the classic level of confusion that we all do, isn't it?
Exactly.
So we can afford to forgive ourselves.
Oh, absolutely. Because it's just silliness, like Nasruddin right there. Yeah. And so the question, can my script be changed, is another obvious, you know, question that is so many people, Course in Miracles students actually believe that you can change something that happened long ago and something that you're just viewing. There are still a lot of Course in Miracles students who believe that you can go to the movie theater and change what's on the screen. And, you know, I don't think that that's what Jesus is saying. I think he's saying you can go to a different movie. You don't have to be in that particular movie if you've learned the lessons that were going, that were there for that. So, and maybe you're still in the script where you're lost your job and you're losing your house and everything is going wrong, but you just don't see it that way. Mm-hmm. And that's the shift.
It seems like there's a couple things happen. I think you touched on them both. Is that in a sense, when we forgive ourselves, we can make hyperleaps, if you will, into different parts of the script. In a sense that we think it's just this one linear script because we think time is linear, and we think that it's just this one little pinhole view of the cosmos. But there's actually all these multiple, even within the dream, multiple realities, and I think we can make hyperleaps, you know, like quantum jumps within the script. Alexander Marchand has a wonderful illustration in one of his books that I kind of co-opted for my second book with, I give him credit for it because I've just adapted it basically. But I think the idea that we and Gary Renard's teachings go into this a bit, that, you know, maybe what happens when we forgive is we're making a quantum jump into another part of the script. It's still the same script in the sense that it's a multidimensional, you know, holographic script with all of these parallel universes or realities or whatever. It's still the same script, but we may bypass some of the forgiveness we need to do if we start generalizing and saying, oh, well, I could apply this here now. Oh, no, I could apply this here. And I think it's a cumulative thing where we start forgiving more and more and more, and then it's like, oh, well, gee, if I keep doing this here, then maybe I could feel more peaceful. And it's not about the results, but I think the results can appear to change or seem to be less. It's not so much that the challenges go away. I think it's that they shift from archetype to archetype. I think that may be the mechanism. That's just my conjecture anyway, so I'll put it out there as that.
I think that's possible.
Yeah.
You know, and it might also just be that your mind changes or shifts to the place where you no longer see what's happening as being problematic.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
I think, you know, a lot of time you just, you know, recognize, oh, well, what was I thinking? What was I worrying about? How did I imagine that was the, you know, the end of my story? Or, you know, really you just see it so much differently that you do actually laugh at the thought. You just laugh at the thought.
Yeah, and I think sometimes we literally see things differently, whether it's a spouse or a life mate or a boss or, you know, someone on the road or, you know, who cuts us off. It doesn't matter if we can see those experiences as reminders to look at our mind. Then instead of flying off the handle or in anger, instead of doing that, we can, you know, begin to see that, you know, we can afford to be grateful. And this kind of ties into that, you know, the appropriate response to anything is always love, because it's either an expression of love or a call for it. So, you know, that's how I think we change the script. Another metaphor that I like a lot is we're watching that movie. We can, you know, perhaps change the, in a quantum sense, the entire theater that we're in. But we can also, moment to moment, maybe that's really the same thing, is we can change the thought system we're using. And there's really only two. There's the inclusion and the exclusion. And in the inclusive script, we have a different, closed caption. We have a different, we switch the director's cut on the DVD. You know, the closed captioning, instead of saying, this guy messed you up, you better get even, the closed caption might be saying, oh, your spouse or your boss or the guy on the road really wants you to pay attention to what's going on in your mind, and this is really a tremendous gift, and doesn't necessarily mean your behavior is going to be different, but your inner dialogue can be dramatically different, and the peace that, that results from that experience, that specific interchange or whatever, can be profoundly different. And that's what I think leads to those quantum shifts that, that we begin to heal the schisms and the splits in our mind.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, that's, I believe, how Jesus did it. That's what happened with Jesus was, you know, he stopped seeing the characters and stopped seeing the act and actions. He saw that, that it was the Christ in action everywhere.
Uh-huh.
And seeing the Christ in action everywhere, saw the face of Christ in everyone that he saw, and he remembered God from that. And, so this is something, you know, this guy is onto with the question, when he's saying, could it be because of my feelings of separation from other people? And, you know, how can I quit being separate? And, you know, that's exactly what Jesus tells us too, is that, you know, this, your suffering comes from this sense of separation, the sense that you are not connected to your source and not connected to your brother. And I think he makes it pretty clear that, and I think we're going to probably get into it. I haven't read the answer, but I think he makes it pretty clear that the way that we do that is by joining with our brother.
Right.
And seeing in our brother, ourselves, seeing mm-hmm. ourselves in, and loving our brother. And as we love our brother, we learn to love ourselves as well. And I find that true in my life. If I invest any part of me into you, like I'm doing right now, I'm investing my thoughts, my feelings, my beliefs, my, you know, everything with you right now, then I can't help but love you because a part of me is in you. You know that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's just the way it is.
Yeah, you know, so interesting. I was walking around the house the other day, and I was thinking, you know, the kind of the classic "all in all," phrase. And I was thinking, I think our egos can see the oneness in all, but I think that this is just kind of a passive ending, but hopefully it will be helpful. But the turning that around is to see that every seeming individual has all, I think is more of a challenge for our egos, because we want to think that there's something outside us that is what's missing. You know, the classic, movie line, "You complete me" kind of thing. We think that there's something outside of us that is going to do it for us, whether it's a person or a circumstance or a substance or a situation or whatever. It doesn't really matter. It's anything that we think is outside then becomes the barrier in our mind to the peace. And but seeing that if all of spirit, and this is one of the exercise in Gary Renard's Fearless Love audio that really clicked for me a few years ago. When I was like walking down the streets of Ashland with this, listening to this on my headphones, and it's like, wow, if I can see all of spirit in every seeming part, every person I see on the street, every lamppost, every tree, every, you know, piece of asphalt, you know, if all of spirit is in every seeming part, then that means it's also true for me. And if I, you know, acknowledge that in everyone and everything I meet, I'm also acknowledging it in myself. And then there's no reason to maintain the belief in separation at that point. So anyway,
exactly.
Hopefully that's helpful.
Half give all to all.
Yeah.
If what you give to all is that, then that is what you will have.
Mm-hmm.
It's the simplest thing ever.
Yeah.
Giving and having and giving are being are the same thing. It really is. It really is what I'm willing to give.
Yeah.
I'll start with the first paragraph.
Okay.
Okay. This person just asked a question case we passed on, that, you know, he was doing great and then he lost everything. And, he was real bitter about it, but now he's coming back and he's wondering how his perception is making his experience, and can he change his experience by changing his perception, and also not being separate from other people. So the answer, in circumstances such as yours, it is really hard to avoid wondering, what am I doing wrong? But that is always the wrong question, and it would seem that part of you is aware of that. It is not helpful to dwell on it first, because there is no way of knowing why you chose this script, and second, because the only relevant issue now that you are experiencing these conditions is whether you will invite the ego or Jesus to guide you and comfort you. Hear Jesus teach about this choice. And this is from text chapter 31, section 8. Temptation has one lesson it would teach in all forms, wherever it occurs. It would persuade the Holy Son of God he is a body, born in what must die, unable to escape its frailty, and bound by what it orders him to feel. It sets the limits on what he can do. Its power is the only strength he has. His grasp cannot exceed its tiny reach. Would you be this if Christ appeared to you in all his glory, asking you but this? Choose once again if you would take your place among the saviors of the world, or would remain in hell and hold your brothers there. For he has come, and he is asking this. Wow, that is just so powerful. What a powerful statement from Jesus that...
it's a pivotal choice each moment, isn't it? I mean...
It is. Absolutely. Yeah. Choose once again. And you know, this is... this is the only choice that we have. You know, free will doesn't mean that, you know, we can... you know, choose the script or make the script different or do anything at all to our experience in the world. Free will says, I can make this choice to either be the savior of the world or be in hell and keep my brothers there.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. What can you say to that? Nothing.
Yeah, I mean, that's really it. Is that if we would condemn any seemingly separate self, we're basically saying, I want to limit myself to my seemingly separate self, which is why I'm saying the ego's jargon is basically saying, I prefer hell to happiness. And that's just crazy, isn't it? And there's no compassion in that for ourselves or each other. And that's why, you know, we all do it together. We, in the sense that, you know, if there's nobody out there, then when we heal our mind and everyone else's mind, it becomes obvious has already healed, but we've just healed our misperception. We've chosen the closed captioning, the director's cut on the DVD that does let everyone off the hook instead of condemns everyone.
You know, and it makes me, it reminds me of this from the first review of A Course in Miracles from lesson 10, or lesson 52, where Jesus says, would I not rather join the thinking of the universe than to obscure all that is really mine with my pitiful and meaningless private thoughts? Yeah.
Pitiful and pathetic, <That's> you mean?
I love that Jesus says, ask you to ask yourself that question. Would I really rather obscure everything with my pitiful and meaningless thoughts? And, you know, of course, you know, logically the answer is no, but boy, do I do that? Do you do that? Yeah. So this is really the choice he's asking.
Did you say less than 10?
Yeah, it's less than 52.
Oh, 52, okay.
It's It's a review.
The review.
Of
oh,
lesson
gotcha.
10.
Yeah. Gotcha. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So it doesn't say that in lesson 10.
There it is. Yeah, I see it. But, yeah, the last sentence of that review lesson. Yeah. Yeah. That is really that's really good. Yeah. That's basically, you know, a reminder that our egos are pathetic. I couldn't help but laughing a little bit, and I didn't want to interrupt the profundity of that quote from chapter 31. But his grasp cannot exceed its tiny reach. Well, in a sense, to parody the parodiers of our current commander in chief,
I know,
who made tremendous fun about the big hands, tiny hands thing. We're all tiny creatures with tiny hands here. I mean, you know, even just looking out the window, we see, well, gee, you know, even if you can only see a few feet past your body, that obviously should be a clue that the self that we made up is intrinsically limited, finite, and designed to be, you know, by default at the mercy of a big, big, mean world out there. And, you know, and that's pretty pitiful and pathetic, isn't it? That we're, you know, apparently, you know, if we take it at face value, at the mercy of a world that's going to devour us and turn us back into compost in just a few decades, you know, or something equivalent.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, and that's why I think that quote is so perfect is, if we think ourself as a body, then we're working with the booby prize substitute version of self, the lowercase s self that, you know, obviously is, you know, born in what must die, unable to escape its frailty and bound by what it orders him to feel. You know, that's pretty pathetic. Yeah, that's really, you know, a sad interpretation, but we don't, that's the whole point of this curriculum is we don't have to yield to that temptation that our senses have been programmed to deliver. If we just choose a different teacher, if we just switch to go back to the settings on the menu and say, okay, instead of director's cut ego, I'm going to go with director's cut Holy Spirit and get a whole different interpretation.
A whole different interpretation. And then you start looking around at these brothers who have really been big characters in the dream. And you thank him for taking one for us, you know. Geez, you know.
Exactly.
You really took on a big role here.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
You know, thank you for doing that because, and I'm thinking in particular our, you know, current president who has given me so many amazing forgiveness opportunities. Oh, my Lord. Mm-hmm. I did not realize how crashed my thinking was until I started looking at these judgments of this person and all these characters, all these actors, and their, you know, all the things that I was accusing them of doing, and even, you know, when it hit me that, no, this is all in the script, you know, you honestly think that, you know, these individuals came up with all this on their own? No, this has been here from the very beginning, ready to show you how convoluted your thinking is and how willing you are to throw your brothers under the bus.
Yeah.
If you think that they have done something that displeases you,
right,
or you think that they're doing something that threatens you, God forbid they do something to threaten my children or, you know, some poor helpless person who, you know, I see as being, small and weak and dependent, you know, so many things I've been looking at because of this whole political situation that I would probably, I thought I had my stuff together. So it really disappointing.
How come suddenly this forgiveness lesson that comes across my TV, radio, and just about in newspaper anywhere I look or listen, it's like, wow, where's this nonstop forgiveness curriculum coming from, right?
And it's, yeah, you know where it's coming from, my nonstop failure to forgive.
Yeah.
Because
and I think
as I continue to fail to forgive, it keeps coming back.
Yeah. And even yesterday's news about the, you know, the down in flames with the replacement to the Affordable Care Act. You know, I was thinking as you were talking, and also yesterday as the news broke, it's like, well, okay, even, you know, the people who are, and again, this is a label because obviously we're all a mixed bag here, and that was part of the awareness of this, that, you know, we all try to have advantage over certain others. And we do it on a very subtle, unconscious level in all cases, but when we see it more blatantly in terms of politicians thinking, well, you know, maybe we don't need to care for, in this case, it's behaviorally, but I think the lesson really is back in the mind is if I don't include everyone in my, mind's embrace, if you will, as being equally important and part of God, then I'm essentially saying I have no compassion. I have no awareness of truth. But that doesn't necessarily have to relate behaviorally, but usually I think it often does. But again, this is where this level of confusion comes in, and this question is, you know, it gets us right back to that question is, what if it's really all about the interpretation and not the behavior, and whether it's passing or not passing legislation or making a left or a right turn at an intersection or, you know, whatever it happens to be, right?
Well, exactly. And, you know, just coming to the realization that everyone is doing the best they can with their very limited knowledge and understanding of what is actually going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like we are blind in the dark and, you know, everything is muffled. We can't hear what's going on. And yeah, we're trying to make decisions about what to think and what to do and what we see. And so with very little real information about anything, I find myself so easy to jump into a judgment. Mm-hmm. And the first part of the judgment is, you know, these people are trying to hurt other people. These people are trying to be, they have no compassion. They have no empathy. You know, these are thoughts that are going on in my
projection,
mind.
Projection.
And, you know, I'm recognizing, well, you know, that's me. I'm having no empathy for them. I have no compassion for them.
Right.
You know, how, and I have to know and understand that everyone is doing absolutely the best they know how with the information that they have and with the understanding and perception that they have. And so, you know, as long as they're continuing from that particular point of view and perception and understanding, they will continue to do what they think is the best thing. And I saw that really with Trump himself, because what I began to see is he's just trying to kind of, you know, make certain people happy, and you know, he doesn't know the whole picture. You know, he doesn't understand a lot of the like national security stuff, and you know, what's classified and what's not, and you know, he's very limited in his understanding of the reality of how things work. And so he's going out blindly, and then he's being advised by people who are equally blind and also who have their agenda of, you know, this is what I think is the best thing. And, you know, and so everybody's...
Don't we all?
Even, yeah, yes, yeah, that's what I'm doing.
Not to on the level of form, try to, as Bill Maher last night was saying, you know, new levels incredulity kind of thing. Obviously, we need to, you know, be practical in the world, but I think the most practical thing we can possibly do is to come back to our mind and recognize that any condemnation is basically, we're imprisoning ourselves. We're calling for our own death sentence, and ultimately. And one of the things that crossed my mind as we were talking is that you know, we really have an opportunity, if we recognize we're in the dark, that you know, we can't find our own asinine thought system with both hands in the dark here. You know, if we're using that thought system, you know, because the ego doesn't really understand itself. It doesn't see what it really is, but it asks us to believe in a non-existent identity that has misinterpreted everything. And that's what we see projected around us unless we start to bring that into question very gently and very calmly and patiently and begin to generalize that over time and say, well, wow, if I'm not at peace with this, maybe those things that I wasn't, you know, peace about previously were all part of that same misunderstanding, you know?
What a thought.
Should I read the next paragraph?
Yeah, please go ahead. Okay. I'm just, when you're talking, I'm thinking about going through the world like Mr. Magoo.
Oh, yeah. Mr. Magoo's a great metaphor, you know? And I think that's where I love probably many scenes in those cartoons where he, you know, escapes peril he's not even aware of by some sort of, you know, you might call it luck or divine providence, whatever. Like he's on a construction site and gets lifted up on a girder that's being hoisted by a crane. And just as he's about to walk off the end of it, he walks onto another girder that's 30 stories in the air. And then when he comes around to the other side of the building and another girder appears and then they lower it down, kind of, you know, that kind of stuff, you know, but he's totally oblivious to that. But I think that's true of all of us in the world, you know, we don't realize that, you know, most of the time we get this tiny little window on a dream. And even within the dream, we don't see a heck of a lot. Okay. Well, let me, I think this probably ties into it. It says, the ego would have you gaze outward and assess what you do not have. Jesus would have you look within and identify with the treasures that are unconditionally yours. And that's where the peace is. It seems as if you have already experienced the peace of God that is not conditional on anything external. And now part of you is questioning whether that is enough to sustain you. A normal wavering for a mind split between two allegiances. In the lesson, I am sustained by the love of God. That's lesson 50. Jesus asks us to look at what we place our faith in as a means of sustenance, happiness, and protection. An honest assessment will reveal that our faith is in whatever will enhance and guaranteed our continued life as a body. Yet Jesus teaches us that, quote, all these things are your replacements for the love of God. That's in the same workbook lesson. In the second paragraph. That is why, however successful we may be in the world's terms, we will never be truly happy and peaceful. That's assuming we're living by the ego's dictates anyway. We would be living a lie, forcing us to conceal the tremendous guilt and fear that choice engenders. So, there again. More food for thought, huh?
Oh, absolutely. And this is, I mean, everybody, you know, when you read that, I am sustained by the love of God and all the things that Jesus tells us in throughout the course, you know, don't worry about things. And, you know, when you have reached this, this is where I've been, where when you reach this certain level of being a teacher of God, that all things will, you know, you don't have to worry about your physical sustenance. You don't have to worry about your body. You don't have to worry about all these things, and all these things are being taken care of. And I used to think that was a kind of a cause and effect thing there, that I would, you know, this was where this whole thought of, if you become enlightened, then, you know, you don't have to worry about these things. Well, no, the fact is, when you become enlightened, you don't worry about these things because you know basically that the script is written and there's nothing that's going to change the outcome no matter what. The only thing that's going to change is your point of view about it. But that the outcome is always the perfect thing. that there has never been a mistake made in all of the script and all of the living of the script, because the script itself is the mistake, but it is fortunately not true. It's an illusion. It's not even real. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if I would be thinking that, you know, if I do good, then God will give me, you know, a better job, or, you know, people will make donations, or, you know, there's that whole bargaining with God.
Mm-hmm.
That's so easy to slip into when you come to this thinking in the Course.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he's saying, I'm sustained by the love of God, that, you know, I don't have to worry about anything. Everything will be given to me. I'll have everything I need. My body will be healthy. These are all things that Jesus says to us in the Course. My body will be healed. And, you know, so we have an expectation then, oh, my needs being fulfilled means that I'm going to get a new car. My needs being fulfilled means that my cancer is going to go away. My needs being fulfilled means that I'm going to gain sight in my eye that I lost. That's not what he's saying. And this is where people get confused, because they're thinking that it's all milk and honey when you have this awakening experience. And that's not true. It is in your mind, milk and honey. In your mind, you see the perfection. Even if you're sitting on a street corner with a sign begging for food, in mind, in your thinking, you are seeing everything as perfection. You're not seeing yourself as a victim. You're not seeing other people as being, you know, anything other than the Holy Son of God. It's the seeing that changes, not the circumstance. So, and I don't know how people study the Course and actually come out believing that there's going to be a change in their physical circumstance when they practice forgiveness, or when they achieve, you know, accept the atonement, or whatever it is. I don't believe that's what he's saying. I don't know. Maybe you have a different thought, but
I was thinking that, in a sense, maybe it's the kind use of the bait and switch in the actual title of the curriculum, Course in Miracles. Well, the ego, you know, and maybe it's, I think Ken Wapnick alludes to this a few times, is, you know, Jesus will, in the Course, will, you know, he's not beneath using a the lowest motivation of you're going to feel better kind of thing as a mechanism for enticing us to try out his Course. And so ultimately the miracle that we think is going to happen in the world really is in the mind, but we have to go through those processes of looking at the ego's strategy, seeing that we've invested in it, seeing that it's not working. And you mentioned something that triggered me. Years ago, I got to hear Elizabeth Kubler-Ross when she was alive in California give a talk, and she's known for these stages of grief, the five stages of grief. I'm from those, I know.
Yes, I'm familiar with that.
And you mentioned bargaining, because that's one of them. And I just did a quick Wikipedia search, and I found it's the denial, which of course is the perfect, you know, example of the ego's, you know, the ego's use of denial is basically saying, oh, well, let's make up a whole universe to hide from the guilt, fear, anger, craziness, you know, and then so it's denial, anger, bargaining, and depression are the first four stages, and the final one, acceptance, is usually there's got to be, you know, something akin to there must be a better way, and that doesn't necessarily mean that you accept it as a peaceful acceptance, but the ego's use of anything is always to find a subtle or not so subtle way of keeping us in the dream. So we, you know, if we can just look at those stages whenever we're involved in denial, anger, bargaining, depression, or, you know, an acceptance that involves there's no peace in the acceptance. You know that
the acceptance is a compromise.
Is a compromise, exactly, because it's not, we're not being asked to accept any compromise, and this world is the compromise. I think that's the whole point of our curriculum here is the interpretation of the world that we've projected out that makes us want to react with those responses, you know, the denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and you know, non-peaceful acceptance. That that whole thought system is what is the only problem there is, and it's a non-existent problem. But it's only because we've chosen to see things in a crazy way.
Yeah. Exactly. And so I'm going to go on to the next paragraph because it will, I think, it will kind of bring that to the fore here. So they say, what might help you, therefore, is to look upon your distress as a crisis of trust. Is the peace of God enough? Is the love of God enough? If your trust were unconditional, you would not need this course. You would not need a teacher who asks only for a little willingness. And that's from chapter 18. You do not have to be at the top of the spiritual ladder to apply this. Jesus approaches us with this lesson very early in the workbook. What better time to work with the lesson than when you are in the midst of a struggle? And then he says, a quote from chapter 17, do not breathe life into your failing ego. Jesus urges us in our moment of wavering. And so these questions, is the peace of God enough? Is the love of God enough? Well, here I'm going to mention a little bit of my crisis of faith here recently is recognizing that I don't really know, I don't really feel the love of God within me now. And there are times when feeling the love of God is almost impossible for me. You know, I sit and concentrate and try and, you know, open myself and, you know, I'm willing, please, you know, help me, fill me with your love, fill my heart with your love. All that kind of stuff, it doesn't work for me. It might help work for other people, but it doesn't work for me. The way I feel the love of God within me is when I express love to another. When I am expressing love and trusting that that love's being accepted and cherished even, then I feel loved. I know it's an artificial feeling. It's not the feeling of the love of God. It's the feeling of the ego's interpretation of what love is, the ego's idea of what love is. I guess what I'm saying is, unless you're actually able to know what the peace of God is or what the love of God is without pretending or giving it attributes that are dependent on the physical world or dependent on some perception or dependent on, you know, you know what happens to me a lot is, you know, I look at the clock and it says 4:44 or 11:11. And I interpret that as a sign, right? Because it's consistent. I don't know what it is. It's consistent. Every day I look at the clock at 4:44. I don't know why that is. But I perceive it and I see it as like spirit talking to me and saying, look, I'm here. Look, I'm here. If I'm not looking for signs, then I'm wandering around feeling like, you know, God's not here. I don't feel God's love. You know, I feel like a liar when I'm, you know, saying these lessons and these things that saying I feel this because it's real obvious that I'm not feeling it. And if I were feeling it, I think if I felt it for even one moment in that completeness of feeling the love of God, I would never ask another question. I would never have another fear. I would never worry again, or distrust or anything. But, and I know that it's available, but that little willingness, which Jesus says is just a little, apparently I am too willing to listen to my ego and not willing enough. You know, I'm not blaming myself. I'm just saying.
I think it's just you, Lynn. I don't think anyone else has that problem.
Darn.
No, and obviously, you know, we're all equivocating. We're all vacillating between two thought systems. We're all, you know, schizophrenically trying to make a dream work that we know is never going to make us happy. And we're all intrinsically, you know, dishonest in that sense, and that we're not completely willing, we're not abundantly willing to look at our egos and realize that they've never, you know, those fraudulent identities that we've clung to so tightly have never made us happy. And I think that's, you know, a gradual process for most of us, and we're not asked to, you know, leap into heaven, as the Course says. We're asked to just look at moment to moment how we're breathing life into our failing ego, as this paragraph concludes. You know, that we're basically just asked to look at how crazy it is that we keep picking up the sword and our shield and fighting off, you know, imaginary monsters and demons and that we made up and that are just part of a silly movie that, you know, we've identified with a character on the screen instead of the moviegoer and the patron in the theater that has chosen to watch this and become so, you know, engaged in the movie that we've forgotten that we're not the character on the screen.
Absolutely. It just is, you know, when you listen to it and you think about it, it makes so much sense. but I'm firmly convinced that the only way you actually experience it, though, because intellectually and conceptually, yes, absolutely sense. But the experience actually comes from the actual practicing of forgiveness. And it actually, that's it. You get the experience from practicing forgiveness. You don't get the experience from intellectualizing or conceptualizing. It is a practice. And that practice, you know, as I do it more and more and more, I come into more and more and more peace. Mm-hmm. I'm beginning to feel this causeless joy, this joy that just comes up when I don't have any objection to what's going on, when I'm letting things be exactly as they are, and when I'm not being a critic of God or the creation. I'm just looking at it and saying, this is, you know, this may not be the world that God made, but it is the world that's here to show me the content of my own mind. So, you know, let's not be criticizing it. Let's just look at it and accept it and forgive my thoughts about it and forgive my thoughts about my brothers. Mm-hmm. That's what brings about that peace.
Yeah.
So you want to go on to the next paragraph? We got about 14 minutes left.
Okay, sure. This obviously will not get you a job or money or other things you would like to have, and it is not meant to deny the frustration of not being able to get a job despite your many attempts to do so. This course should not be used as a means of avoiding one's responsibilities in the world under the guise of spiritual advancement, although unfortunately it has been used that way by many. Because, of course, you know, we can all abuse anything in the name of, you know, ego's agenda, right? And that's, I think, what it's saying here is, you know, don't use the feedback as a way to say, oh, gee, you know, I must be this horrible, you know, horrible self because I'm not getting the results I want. Well, that's just, using the ego's interpretation to reinforce as Ken Wapnick says, a maladaptive solution to a non-existent problem once again. But that's okay. I mean, there's nothing wrong with doing that. It's just silly. It's just not effective. So it goes on to say, its purpose is to help us see that the only meaningful aspect of our lives is learning how to use our experiences as a way of getting in touch with the content in our minds that we are always choosing. As we choose against the ego and for Jesus and his thought system of forgiveness more and more, we will approach our problems entirely differently. Not that we will ignore them, but that we will no longer give them power to disrupt the peace that defines us as God's son. And I'll hold off there, and we can, if you have any comments on that, because I think there's plenty in that paragraph too.
Absolutely, and this is exactly what we're talking about, is choosing against the ego and for Jesus, choosing forgiveness more and more. That's really what's happening is that constant choice. And I was talking about this yesterday, I took a lot of English classes because I got a degree in technical writing and editing. And, the teacher, one of my teachers was very big on, she did a little actions with things. And so she says, you know, what is the difference between the word continuous and the word continual? And a lot of people think, well, this is the same thing, basically continuous. No, continual means that there's intermittent. So it's like a bell going ding, ding, ding. Continuous means that it never stops.
Right.
So continuous is like a bell that goes ding, 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 like an alarm bell, right?
Or maybe it's just one long tone that has
exactly,
no
change. Has no
fluctuation.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So we're not continually, although I am continually reminding myself for forgiveness, but what Jesus is suggesting is that we do it continuously, unendingly, what he calls, you know, being vigilant only for God and his kingdom is really continuously looking at our thoughts, continuously practicing forgiveness, never relenting, never giving up, never falling off the wagon. You know, that's really the what happens when you move into that experience is that then nothing disturbs you.
Right.
Then everything is seen as perfect.
Yes, yes. I was going to say that probably is, you know, what you were just saying is really the vision that we're being asked to consider, that we, you know, have put barriers in front of that. And that really can be our continuous experience of peace. And what, you know, what you might say at the top of the ladder, where Jesus says that God takes the final step and lifts us back into heaven. Again, these are metaphors for, you know, the perfect oneness, the reality that not the non-physical spiritual reality that really has nothing to do with the dream of space-time and bodies and personas and seemingly separate selves. That is, you know, I think what we not only can, but ultimately all will aspire to and implement. But in the meantime, he gives us all these wonderful strategies for looking at our resistance and for seeing how when we do waver and when we go back and forth between the two thought systems, that we can give ourselves a little more willingness each time by seeing the results. Just he basically is very pragmatic. He says, you know, just look at the results. You know, when are you at peace and when are you not at peace? And just notice the nature of the thinking that accompanies each of those experiences. And sure enough, if you just pay attention long enough, you'll say, you know, by golly, when I'm not at peace, it's because I've chosen the thought system of separation and all that attends it. And it's no fun. It's just not any fun. And why would I choose that? And then that motivates us each time more and more to be more continuous in our choice and to be intolerant of the mind wandering that, that makes those gaps that, you know, take us out of that peace. But we're not, again, we're not at the mercy of the world and the ego's thought system. We've chosen a thought system that's unmerciful, but we can also choose a thought system of mercy, which is what the Holy Spirit or Jesus of the Course represents. And that mercy is really the kindness and the forgiveness and the gentleness and the soothing quality of the reminders and the awareness we took with us into the dream that tell us, you know, nothing happened here. You did not throw God under the bus. The true reality that cannot change has not been compromised by anything that you dreamt, including anything involving space or time or individuality or ego's whole thought system of sin, guilt, and fear. You know,
and your brother didn't either.
Exactly.
You know, that's the thing. Nobody has done anything. Your brother didn't do anything either.
Exactly.
And you know, and Jesus, and I'm going to find where he says this, that the justification, and it's not in the justification for forgiveness section, so I've looked, but the actual reasoning behind all of forgiveness is that nothing ever happened. Mm-hmm. And you know, as long as I keep thinking something is happening and keep looking at what appears to be happening and projecting thoughts into the future about what's going to happen next and what's going to happen next and what's going to happen in 100 years and what's going to happen in, you know, when my children are, you know, grown, or these are all speculations on unreality. They come from the wrong premise altogether. Uh-huh. And so, you know, and this is what he's also saying. He says being of one mind, you know, that's the condition for miracle readiness. Well, being of one mind is not being conflicted and saying, you know, well, if I only did this, this would happen. But yet none of what I'm doing has any effect on the future because it's an illusion. So, you know, on one hand, I'm thinking there's cause and effect that I'm in charge of. And on the other hand, I'm thinking that there's not. And I'm actually really, really thinking that it's all me, that I'm in charge of all of it, and I'm responsible for everything that's going to happen. That's how the ego works, and the ego has us believing that somehow or the other our actions and activities have long-range effects or even immediate effects. They have no effect whatsoever. That's what Jesus is telling us. There's nothing you can do to change what never was. There's nothing you can do to affect an illusion. It is an illusion. It's in your own mind. You know, it's like, you know, thinking that my thoughts are going to, you know, suddenly make my trees grow bigger or, you know, cause my cancer to go away. There's nothing you can do in your thinking that's going to change the circumstance of the illusion. The only way to get out of the illusion or to stop believing it is to leave. You know, when you get in the desert, you know, the only thing you can do is leave. You don't stay and try to change the desert. You get out.
That's it. And it's all desert here.
It's all desert.
And I think I was reminded of that when we took a little jaunt down the coast into Florence, Oregon, which is about a half hour from here, last weekend. And we were walking along the beach and I was thinking, well, what's a beach but a sand dunes, you know? And well, at least the one we were on anyway. And what do you think of sand? Well, that's a desert. Well, it's just a desert with a bunch of water next to it.
Uh-huh.
but then I realized, okay, well, I need to generalize this. It's like, well, everything here is, no matter how much we paint it with a paradise, you know, spray paint, it's really just something that we made up as a replacement, and a distraction from the fact that, you know, as, and I just looked this up, it is, this from chapter 31, you know, that we're in the world uncertain, lonely, and in constant fear as ego denizens. You know, that's our lot in life, but we mask that over by, you know, momentary, you know, bursts of pleasure or seeming safety or wow, I escaped that monster this time and I overcame this obstacle And so we keep thinking that all these little achievements are gonna finally someday kick in and get us home. But there really isn't any stability to a dream. I mean, fantasies are intrinsically unstable, and so therefore there's the uncertainty and the loneliness and the fear that come from that are what we need to look at, but not with any kind of condemnation, just with say, oh, well, yeah, sure enough, that really hasn't made me happy, and I can afford to be, to see things differently. I can choose to see things differently.
Exactly.
Do you want to read the last paragraph, starting with Jesus thus encourages us?
Okay, sure. So Jesus thus encourages us. You surely have begun to realize that this is a very practical course. And this is from chapter 8. So by 8 chapters, we should realize this. This is a very practical course and one that means exactly what it says. I would not ask you to do things you cannot do, and it is impossible that I could do things that you cannot do. Given this, and given this quite literally, nothing can prevent you from doing exactly what I ask, and everything argues for your doing it. I give you no limits, because God lays none on you. And that's from text chapter 8, section 9. This is it. I mean, this is our, get out of jail free card, really. Mm-hmm. It is, basically saying there's no reason. He's not scolding us. He's just saying there's no reason you can't do what I did. Mm-hmm. And, there's nothing that's preventing you from doing it. All of your, job, no job, money, no money, family, no family, love, no love, all that has no meaning. Health, no health, that has no meaning. Nothing's going to prevent you from doing it. And everything argues for you to do it.
Right.
Because God has given you no limit. And that also means that God has given me no behaviors. God hasn't said, you got to meditate 3 times a day. God hasn't said you got to do this or that or the other. Jesus gives us lessons that are practices that are helpful, but there's no you have to do this every day for the rest of your life. Do it 365 days, and if you did it right, even one of those days. If you could actually do what Jesus is telling us, even from the very first simplest lesson, mm-hmm. If you just knew that nothing really means anything, and if I think it does, I'm the one who made it up.
Yeah.
I'm the one that gave it all its meaning. If you knew that, then you would have none of this confusion.
Nothing real can be threatened, huh?
Exactly. Absolutely. All right. Well, thank you so much, Bruce Rawls. This has been another lovely Saturday morning.
Indeed.
And
thank you,
the wind finally stopped blowing yesterday. So I think half of Colorado is in Kansas now. Because of such terrible winds we've had. Hmm. But 75-mile-an-hour winds out in Pueblo West, bending steel fence posts and such. So. Hmm. This is pretty bad.
Wow.
But that was just a dream.
Yeah.
Just a dream. All right.
Thanks,
all right,
as always,
thank
Linda,
so
and everyone. And I'll post this on, as always, I have a backlog of other ones that we've done on ACIM blog. And the article that I mentioned in the chat was with Bob Rosenthal is up there on the website, and also be doing one with C.A. Brooks that I did record recently with her. So, yeah. Okay.
Very cool.
Have a great week.
All right.
Week,
I posted the link to the one to Bob Rosenthal in the room so people could go check it out, which I'm going to go do right now. Although I'm going to listen to Deb and Barb. All right. Thanks a lot, Bruce.
Have a great week,
brother.
All. Love to all. Bye.
Bye-bye.